armed gangs and have been then beaten and driven around the streets. One boy had his teeth knocked in, and they are forced then to inform on family members or friends or people that they know in the villages who have attended democratic protests or have attended political gatherings. Inside the prisons, people have been waterboarded. They've been beaten with truncheons on their bare bodies and on their feet. They've been hung for hours, days, and deprived of sleep. They have been anally raped with truncheons. They have been just the cruelest, most inhumane treatment.
Nonetheless, the British government continues to support the regime. When construction began on a new permanent naval base in Bahrain in 2015, then UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said this.
This will give us the flexibility to respond to any emerging challenge in the Gulf, whether it's from a state actor or a non-state actor, whether it's from within the Gulf or outside the Gulf. This enhances our range. It gives Britain a permanent naval base east of Suez for the first time since 1967.
Strategic interests seem to be Westminster's priority. According to Human Rights Watch, arbitrary arrests, torture, executions and forced disappearances continue with very little interference from so-called democracies. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With the name of martyr Qasim Soleimani decorating the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a, the first graduates of the department walking down it, reviving the memory of Haj Qasim, who they carried his name as a title for their badge.
When we talked about the Persian language, it was impossible to learn it because of the international fight against it, and whoever spoke it was considered as the enemy of Islam. Today, however, we have proof to the world that we and the Iranian people are brothers, and Islam unites us.
Graduates expressed their overwhelming joy of this accomplishment, stressing that their choice name for the Soleimani badge comes at a critical time in light of American unilateralism reaching its peak.
Sadaf Fihad, martyr Soleimani, is a first in the region, and his support for the Palestinian cause requires us to revive his memory by naming a badge in his name.
The ceremony came after Hassan Erlu presented his credentials to the President of the Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, as Ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen. This shows the depth of the Yemeni-Iranian relations, especially with the U.S. escalating its hostile policies towards the two countries and towards the resistance axis as a whole. Erlu's predecessor left Sana'a in September 2015, and in October last year, Iran's foreign ministry said the process of sending a new ambassador was hindered by attacks on the embassy.
While some Persian Gulf Arab states' leaders rushed to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, Yemenis continued to reaffirm their support for the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
It is revealed that the actual number of migrant children and infants separated from their parents is significantly higher than previously thought, according to an email obtained by NBC News. In the email, Stephen Herzog, the lawyer leading the effort to locate the children's relatives and reunite the families, says that 666 children, about 20% of whom were under the age of 5, when they were ripped away from their parents, remain separated. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading Lawyers Can't Reunite 666 Seized Migrant Children with Parents, 121 More Than Previously Believed. Here's the details of this article. Last month, the world was shocked and outraged to learn that lawyers tasked with locating relatives of child migrants seized by U.S. immigration agents under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy were unable to locate the parents of 545 children. Now it turns that the actual number of children and infants separated from their parents is significantly higher than previously thought, according to an email obtained by NBC News. In the email, Stephen Herzog, the lawyer leading the effort to locate the children's relatives and unite the family, says that 666 children, about 20% of whom were under the age of 5, when they were ripped away from their parents, remain separated. Herzog attributes the initial undercount to the fact that the U.S. government did not provide phone number contacts for 129 of the minors. "We would appreciate the government providing any available updated contact information or other information that may be helpful in establishing contact for all 666 of these parents," Herzog wrote to Justice Department attorneys representing the Trump administration. Last month, the House Judiciary Committee released a scathing report revealing the U.S. administration knew it would not be able to reunite migrant families when planning the zero-tolerance separation policy, but implemented it anyway. The Democratic-led committee spent 21 months investigating the planning and execution of the administration policy, which resulted in the seizure of more than 2,500 migrant children, including some with physical and mental disabilities, from their parents, the majority of whom are believed to have been deported from the U.S. Both parents and children, who were often told by U.S. officials that they would never see each other again, have suffered tremendous emotional and psychological trauma that Physicians for Human Rights has called torture and state-sanctioned child abuse. The federal government often separated families who presented themselves at U.S. ports of entry and legally requested asylum after fleeing violence and persecution in their home countries, much of it resulting from U.S. policies and actions.
So
Some of the children have been given to U.S. families who are sometimes able to petition for permanent custody of them, and some of the children may indeed never see their parents again. In late June 2018, as public outrage mounted in the face of stories like a breastfeeding baby being torn away from her mother and a father driven to suicide after being separated from his wife and child, the U.S. administration reluctantly rolled back the policy, which along with forced surgical removal of reproductive organs of migrant women has been called the Trump administration's worst domestic human rights violation. U.S. President Donald Trump, on the other hand, continues to defend the separation policy while falsely claiming that deceased children were brought into the country by human traffickers. Biden has called family separation criminal, but has not said whether or not he would seek to punish Trump or any of the administration officials who planned and executed the policy. Lee Gillernt, the deputy director of the American Civil Liberties Union ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, told the network that the new statistic includes individuals in addition to 545 for whom we got no information from government that would allow meaningful searches, but are hopeful the government will now provide with that information. The Department of Homeland Security and the DOJ did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family.
The resistance at the beginning of Beisat resulted in 3 years of unbelievable resistance in Shebe Abi Talib. Children cried through the night out of hunger. The sound of their crying could be heard in Mecca, and some of the kind-hearted disbelievers of Quraysh felt sympathetic towards them, but no one dared to help them due to their fear of the powerful. That was while the faith of the early Muslims, whose children wasted away before their eyes, there were many people who died there. Many were plagued with diseases, and many suffered from starvation, was not shaken. The commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, told his dear son, Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, The mountains may be shaken, they may be removed, but your faith must not be shaken. That was the same piece of advice that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, gave in his testament. That is the way the Islamic Ummah must rise up. That is what the Beisat of the Islamic Ummah means. That is the lesson that the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family taught us. That is what Beisat teaches us.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My faith to be stronger.
We say that the holy existence of the great prophet and messenger of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, is the most important point in creating unity. We have said before that the world of Islam can meet at this point. This is a point where the emotions of all Muslims are connected to one another. This is the center of love and affection in the world of Islam. Of course, you can witness that in the present time, some authors who are financially supported by the Zionists pay attention to this center and insult it. They do this so that the importance of insulting the Islamic Ummah and humiliating the world of Islam diminishes. This is the main point.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The number of forcibly displaced persons around the world has increased dramatically, reaching almost 80 million. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the number of refugees has also gone up from roughly 15 million a decade ago to 26 million today. And 77% of the refugees find themselves in a protracted situation, defined as having remained displaced without a durable solution, such as voluntary return to their home countries following the resolution of conflicts, resettlement, or local integration for more than 5 years. Because of persistent conflicts, only 3.9 million refugees were able to return to their homes between 2010 and 2019. Compared to roughly 10 million between 2000 and 2010, and 15.3 million in the 1990s. Meanwhile, the European Union's new pact for migrants makes little allowance for how the COVID-19 pandemic is going to impact the EU's migration and asylum policies. The pandemic has profoundly affected the capacity of host countries to manage the presence of refugees and ensure their protection. Already fragile health infrastructures are stretched in helping local populations, let alone refugees. The pandemic has also eroded income from trade, tourism, and crucial revenue from remittances. The pact should recognize the dire forced migration picture, the impact of COVID-19, and the associated expected rise in poverty. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Kemal Qureshi, M. Murat Erdogan, and Nihal Eminoglu, titled EU's New Pact on Migration and Asylum Missing a True Foundation. The article was published on Brookings.edu website. Please stay with us for more. On 23rd of September, the European Commission launched a new Pact on Migration and Asylum, proposing to overhaul the European Union's long-ailing policies in this area. European Union Vice President Margaritis Schinas likened the pact to a building with three floors, comprised of an external dimension centered around strengthened partnerships with countries of origin and transit, robust management of external borders, and firm but fair internal rules. The Commission proposal must still make its way through the legislative process in the European Parliament and the European Council. The problem is the pact needs a foundational basement in the form of recognizing that an overwhelming majority of the world's refugees are hosted in developing countries. Without a basement, the whole edifice is undermined. The European Union must incorporate policy ideas from the Global Compact on Refugees, GCR, to rectify this. The pact's external dimension, which calls for strengthening partnership with countries of origin and transit in the EU's immediate neighbourhood and beyond, is its ground floor. The second floor relates to policies to fortify and improve the management of the EU's external borders. The third floor proposes rules to resolve the long-standing challenge within the EU to achieve a more balanced distribution of responsibilities and promote solidarity among EU members in dealing with asylum seekers and refugees. At all three levels, the pact has faced intense pushback. With respect to the third floor, the Commission has been criticized for catering to the priorities of the more conservative and anti-immigrant member states such as Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia. The pact allows members to opt out from participating in the relocation of asylum seekers and refugees within the EU by offering them the possibility to instead provide administrative and financial support to other member states. Serious doubts have been expressed about the viability of this scheme. On the second floor, the big concern is that, once again, border security has been prioritized over access to asylum. While emphasizing the principle of non-refoulement as enshrined in international refugee law, the pact at the same time introduces measures that are clearly meant to complicate the possibility that individuals fleeing persecution and conflicts can seek to obtain protection in the European Union. A former director of the Center for Refugee Studies at Oxford University sees these measures as aiming to harden and formalize the fortress Europe. Migrants and refugees were to be kept out of Europe at all costs. The emphasis on protecting Europe's borders becomes most evident at the ground floor. Here the pact calls the revamping partnership with third countries and reflects the European Union's long-standing policy of externalizing the cost and responsibility of managing its external borders. Tying policy issues such as development assistance, trade concessions, security, education, agriculture, and visa facilitation for third country nationals to those countries' willingness to cooperate on migration management has long been criticized as asymmetrical. The pact takes this relationship to a new coercive level by suggesting the possibility of applying restrictive visa measures to third countries unwilling to be cooperative. Time will tell whether these problems on each floor will be addressed as the Commission proposal makes its way through the legislative process. However, there is a deeper structural problem to the pact, resulting from the missing basement. This is because the pact fails to account for two major global realities confronting the European Union. The problem is that the pact is so inward-oriented that it fails to recognize the policy implications of the dire state of forced migration globally. The number of forcibly displaced persons has increased dramatically, reaching almost 80 million individuals. According to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the number of refugees alone has gone up from roughly 15 million a decade ago to 26 million today. And 77% of the refugees find themselves in a protracted situation, defined as having remained displaced without a durable solution, such as voluntary return to their home countries following the resolution of conflicts, resettlement, or local integration for more than 5 years. Because of persistent conflicts, only 3.9 million refugees were able to return to their homes between 2010 and 2019, compared to roughly 10 million between 2000 and 2010, and 15.3 million in the 1990s. Secondly, the pact makes little allowance for how the COVID-19 pandemic is going to impact the European Union's migration and asylum policies. The pandemic has profoundly affected the capacity of host countries to manage the presence of refugees and ensure their protection. Already fragile health infrastructures are stretched in helping local populations, let alone refugees. The pandemic has also eroded income from trade, tourism, and crucial revenue from remittances. The pact should recognize the dire forced migration picture, the impact of COVID-19, and the associated expected rise in poverty. The Economist and the United Nations have noted that the pandemic risks undoing the gains made against poverty in the past 2 decades. According to the World Bank, most affected will be developing countries, where more than 85% of these refugees are hosted. Is likely to erode the capacity of these countries to cope with the presence of refugees and manage public resentment as competition for scarce resources between refugees and locals intensifies. Under these circumstances, it would not be unrealistic to expect pressures for secondary movements towards the EU to build up, reminiscent of the ones that occurred during 2015 and 2016. The European Union has an interest in recognizing the reality presented by the basement floor, and should supplement policies on the first floor and above accordingly. A former UNHCR official points out, the pact hardly makes any reference to the Global Compact on Refugees, GCR, but it could be a so-called inspiring source of policy ideas. The idea of the Global Compact on Refugees emerged from the September 2016 United Nations Summit in New York that was held to address the challenges resulting from the European migration crisis. Adopted in December of 2018, the Global Compact on Refugees recognizes that the traditional refugee protection system based on the 1951 Geneva Convention is under duress, if not broken. Against this reality, it calls on the international community to work together in the spirit of burden and responsibility sharing to improve the self-reliance of refugees and the resilience of their host communities, as well as help hosts transform refugees from being a humanitarian burden to a development and economic opportunity. All European Union member countries, apart from Hungary, have endorsed the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees. Though the pact fails to acknowledge the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees, the European Union Vice President Margaritis Schinas promises to seek global solutions and responsibility sharing with international partners on migration, as well as proposes to establish a union resettlement and humanitarian admission framework regulation that would provide a stable EU framework for the European Union contribution to global resettlement efforts. These reflect at least the spirit of the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees. However, the European Union needs to go beyond this and heed to the Global Compact on Refugees call to promote economic opportunities, decent work, job creation and entrepreneurship programs for host community members and refugees in refugee hosting countries. Then can the European Union enjoy a solid basement floor for the rest of the pact. The Global Compact on Refugees offers a rich array of innovative policy suggestions that the European Union can take into consideration when negotiating partnerships with countries hosting large numbers of refugees. One such policy idea calls for a more active involvement of the private sector in supporting self-reliance of refugees through decent and sustainable employment. In its partnership agreement, the European Union could include terms incentivizing companies to offer such opportunities for refugees. This could be enabled by extending preferential trade arrangements for countries hosting large numbers of refugees, which is something the Global Compact on Refugees mentions. Such partnerships with the European Union could be conditioned to refugees being offered sustainable employment opportunities. The advantage of all this is that the resulting economic growth would also benefit host communities, support social cohesion, and help empower already fragile economies coming out of the COVID-19-induced economic recession. It would also give the partnerships that the European Union is advocating for at the ground floor of the pact a much more solid foundation based on a cooperative spirit rather than the current formulation. In this way, the new pact would help create a win-win-win outcome, benefiting refugees, benefiting the host countries, and benefiting the EU.
Debate. Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. President Donald Trump has every right not to concede the presidential election, and Americans should allow the election process to unfold. These were the words of Senator Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor on Monday as he declined to acknowledge Joe Biden's victory and said that Donald Trump has every right to look into allegations and request recounts. Meanwhile, the U.S. Attorney General, William Barr, has authorized federal prosecutors to begin investigating irregularities. In this edition of The Debate, we will investigate what all of this means for the U.S. and to begin with, we are joined by our correspondent to give us an update.
Yeah, so right now there are several legal challenges that are happening across the nation as the president seeks to refute some of the election results. And we're looking at some of those battleground states like Michigan and Arizona, Nevada, and of course, Pennsylvania. These are all states that were key in the president-elect's victory and trying to achieve that magic 270 number, which means that he received most of the votes in the electoral, he would receive most of the votes in the Electoral College. And the reason why I made that correction just now is just because the president-elect reached 270 doesn't automatically make him president. Once the votes are certified in every state, then the Electoral College votes on the results, then he officially becomes the president-elect or the president of the United States. So there's still a little bit of a process here, but the current president is putting that on hold as he tries to, again, dispute some of these election results. He believes that he is the winner. Whether or not he really believes that, that remains to be seen. But for right now, he's putting up legal challenges across the nation, holding up the process, making it very difficult for the transition team to go through the proper process to go into the presidency in 2021.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C. Now, to continue this discussion, we're joined by senior geopolitical analyst Patricia De Gennaro from Washington, D.C. also. Thank you very much for joining us, ma'am. With the support that Trump has, how far do you think these allegations can go?
I don't think they can go very far at all. I mean, the results have come in. We've had more people participate in this election than we have in history, which actually is a very good thing. And I think what the president should be doing is taking advantage of the opportunity to really embrace the democratic process and how it's gone through right now. I mean, he had a substantial amount of votes. He still didn't win the popular vote, and he still does not have all electoral votes. In any other time in history, This is just an unprecedented type of behavior, but what else would we expect from this administration?
Thank you very much. Let's go to our other guest right there, editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris from Phoenix. If you could please tell us what you think with the support that Trump has. Do you think he will go very far with these allegations, or will it just stay in the news?
Oh, absolutely. Trump's going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court if needed. What we're witnessing here is the attempt of a theft of the election by the Democrat Bolshevik Party that is taking over, trying to take over the U.S. That and the resistance of the deep state. There's collaboration with the major media. There's collaboration with the social media. And this is not to be tolerated. The American people have had enough. You know, we've been lied to by our government since 1963 when they murdered JFK in broad daylight and said it was Lee Harvey Oswald and not a conspiracy. And so we figured it out. We understand that the government lies and the media lies and that we're no longer going to tolerate it. You saw tremendous outpouring of support for Trump. I mean, 58,000 people show up for him at rallies. You know, Biden's lucky if he can get 12 and half of those are staffers. So we, as the American people, are not going to sit down and let this election be stolen from the will of the people by the chicanery that that the Democrats pull on a regular basis. I mean, they really haven't won a legitimate election in over 50 years.
I can see that Patricia disagrees with you. If you'd like to make any comments here before I ask the next question.
You know, I think it's really, as someone who's very nonpartisan, I think it's really irresponsible to make these kinds of claims. They're alleged claims, even in Pennsylvania, where I happen to actually grow up through this out of the courts. I mean, the election wasn't stolen. There's no evidence of that. And I really think as a society and to support the American democratic process, we are undermining our own system here with comments like you're making. And it's a very, very dangerous precedent to make. You make it now, it will happen in the future. This is not about Republican or Democrat. This is about upholding a democratic system. People voted, they expected their votes to be counted, they were counted, and this is the outcome. Now we have to accept the legitimate outcome. It will be verified, and I think it's premature to say all of the, you know, the critical elements that you're saying and really, really claiming that people are fraudulent. I mean, can you prove that? Do you have anything to prove that?
Patricia,
people are tired of this president.
Patricia, I'm sorry to cut you off right there, but Mike here mentioned the media and especially the role of social media. I'd like to know what you think. We can see, for instance, CNN is calling Fox News a television that's supporting Trump, and it's basically what the media is actually playing out here, not facts that are being told.
Well, yes, and let me answer that question. I think the media is being completely irresponsible as well. I mean, they're jumping ahead, they're fighting battles, and they're fighting corporate battles. If you want to talk about a deep state, you can talk about the people with billions of dollars who are influencing a government. That is your deep state corruption. And I'm sorry to say that a lot of the supporters out there are those, you know, Sheldon Adelson and others with billions of dollars. I mean, come on, there's your deep state, and they're supporters of Trump.
Thank you very much. Now let's go back to Mike. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has just said that there would be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. What do you make of this comment?
Well, I think Pompeo is being very forward-looking, and I think whenever the final tally is done, Trump is going to have won. Now, we have to separate out what are the legal ballots from the illegal ballots. 2 days ago, Steve Pachinik came out and announced that there are quantum-encrypted watermarks on all of the legal ballots, and that the National Guard is in the process of separating those out. 78% of those, of the first 14 million, have been for Trump. 25% have been for Biden. So as this thing shakes out and the illegal ballots are culled from the system, we're going to find that Trump had a resounding victory and that this is an attempt to steal it. Now, I do agree with Patricia that we need to get the big money out of there. We don't need to have the Sheldon Adelsons and the oligarch billionaires, whether it's social media or the gambling tycoons, trying to influence our election. This country is set up for the benefit of the American people, and that has been stolen from us. And
It's not been stolen. I mean, that is just irresponsible discussion.
Well, get to call the election. That's not the media's job.
They don't get to call the elections, the democratic process doesn't work and the election is stolen. It's not a stolen election. You can't prove that at this point.
It is absolutely a stolen election. The media does not have the authority to call the election, and yet that's what they're attempting to do. And the social media is censoring anyone who challenges what the mainstream media is saying.
I disagree with that, but I'm not going to sit here and say anyone has stolen an election without proof.
There is plenty of proof. Look at Bedford Law.
Bedford Law,
for example, does not support it. Bedford Law has been used in prior fraud cases to prove election fraud. Bedford Law completely applies to Wisconsin, applies to Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona. It applies across the board.
You're sitting here making Republican talking points, and if that's all that this discussion is about, I mean, it's not worth the time.
Okay, so Patricia, if you could please tell us, why is Mike Pompeo talking about a second Trump administration?
Because Mike Pompeo is just as irresponsible as all of the other people right now that are trying to undermine and disrupt a democratic system. I completely agree that we should wait for the GSA, the General Security Association, to be able to certify this election and, quite frankly, shut off the media if you don't want to hear what they're saying. But I think it is very irresponsible to try to undermine a democracy, to try to promote division currently, and to blame people for fraud before you can prove any of those things. It's unconscionable in my mind in a democratic society.
Okay, so Patricia, what we see here on this show, I'm sorry, Mike.
Patricia, on one point, please. Let me agree with her on one point. Protecting the process is the most fundamental thing that we as Americans can do. And when many of us witness blatant fraud, and it's obvious
fraud. No, it's not blatant fraud.
It is. We witnessed it on the election night. Fox News
we
called.
We did not witness it on the election night. I beg to differ with you.
May I please finish, Patricia? Well, Patricia, may I please finish? Please, you don't need to interrupt. I mean, honest. Whenever Fox News called Virginia when only 8% of the tally was in, and yet they don't call Pennsylvania when 98% is in for Trump, there's a little bit of an imbalance there. And so
why is it that your argument is that the media should not be calling the election, yet you're quoting the media that is calling the election? You do not have to listen to this. If we all want to wait for a valid count, we can wait for the system and the process to be done. Calling it fraudulent at this point is just incorrect. It's an allegation. And
well,
as
I
an American citizen,
I
totally resent you, you know, questioning me as an American as well. And that's what you're doing.
So, Patricia, I'm very sorry, but let's continue this discussion. First of all, it's very interesting for me, looking from the outside of the United States, and you two both are Americans, it is very clear that your society is deeply polarized, and no matter what we bring up, the issue of election fraud comes up. I would like to know why this is the case, and is there a possibility that the election results are overturned, Patricia?
Well, the idea of fraud has come up because they're Republican talking points. That's the bottom line. And they continue to say them over and over to undermine democracy and influence thoughts and the processes of the population and the people. So, I mean, this administration has been expert at information and information influence. And they are, you know, they are right aligned with the social media. So I don't think at this point that this election can be overturned. I think that people have spoken. It's been very close, not quite as close as the last election, where actually Hillary Clinton did get the popular vote, and she could have, you know, claimed fraud as well. But, you know, we let the system play out. They welcomed Donald Trump into the White House, and it's a peaceful transition. That is America, and that is the society, and that is the system that we need to protect.
So do you think that the election results can be overturned?
Because they did not welcome Donald Trump into the White House.
Yes,
the FBI at Obama's direction.
In their
spying on Donald Trump and trying to undermine Obama was the first one to abrogate and to violate the peaceful transition by his actions against Trump. Everything they've done against
you
Trump.
You know, sir, I'm not sure that you really understand politics or the process, or you're close to it.
Oh, really? Really? You're going to lecture me? I was finance chairman for the Republican Party during the 1994 election cycle, all right? I ran
well,
for
then
governor
of Arizona
in 2006.
Needs
you don't
to
tell
go
me.
I don't understand politics.
I understand politics better than you ever will, lady.
Okay, and Mike, if you could please tell us what you think. Can the results of these elections be overturned? Is there a possibility for that?
Well, first of all, the election has not been officially called, so therefore cannot be overturned. What's going to happen is the news media's call is going to be overturned. And we're going to find out that the legitimate winner of this election has been all along President Donald J. Trump. And not only that, but the down ticket votes are also going to be examined and audited. And we're going to find out other Democrat cheating across the board. And we might have some new people, some new faces in a number of these elections. And I'll look at the Senate race in Michigan, where the black gentleman, Jack, I forget his last name, was way, way, way ahead until they closed down at midnight. They woke up at 4 o'clock, and suddenly there's 100,000 new votes in there that didn't exist prior to that, when they're supposed to be closed. How is that possible? This is blatant, open, in-your-face fraud. And Patricia, if you can't see it, I'm sorry. You better take your blinders off or get new glasses, something.
Okay, so we really don't have that much time left. Patricia, no matter what the results of these elections, do you think that there would be a peaceful transition?
I hope there would be a peaceful transition. That is who the American people are, and that is how our society works. So I think we should wait for the elections to be verified by the correct agencies and administration, and I hope no one will prohibit that from happening or play politics to make that not happen. So I would think that if that does not happen, we are really in trouble as a country to not have a peaceful transition, which is our historical way of doing things.
Thank you very much. And Mike, your opinion, do you think that no matter what the results, so would there be a peaceful transition?
Well, I pray for a peaceful transition. I also pray for a legitimate election result that comes out, because right now the process, according to the media, is not legitimate. We have to wait for the process to run its course. However, I do fear that whichever way it goes, there's going to be some violence, because one side or the other is going to be inordinately unhappy with whatever happens, whoever is declared the winner. And so I really would like to see that avoided, but I would more importantly protect the process of the election and do not allow fraudulent and illegal votes to have the same weight as the legal vote of American citizens. That is not right. We have to defend the process and defend the legal vote against the illegal votes that the Democrats have propagated across the entire system.
Now, my final question for both of you is mostly with regards to the U.S.'s image across the world. The U.S. has always claimed to be a role model, especially when it comes to democracy. Now, how do you think these recent events have affected the global image of the United States? Patricia?
I think it's hindered and it's really hurt the global image of America. I mean, a lot of the countries out there are just not looking at us like we know how to keep our own house in order. And we don't have a leadership that is trying to unite and prevent the violence. When Joe Biden was elected, when people thought Biden had won the election, there was actually a lot of celebration. So, I mean, I didn't see any violence, and I live right here in Washington, D.C., so there was no even view of violence. So I really think that we have to be positively supporting each other and bridge those divisions and understand that this is a democratic process and people lose and they have to transition out of office.
Thank you very much. And Mike, your opinion, do you think this has affected the U.S.'s global image?
Well, I think the U.S. Tarnished its global image going back to 9/11, when they never caught the real perpetrators and blamed it on 19 Arab hijackers to justify illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's pretty obvious that the U.S. has been run by a cadre of gangsters for a very, very long time. It's time for Donald Trump to come in there and actually drain the swamp and clean house. I mean, if the U.S. has a bad image globally, it's because the management class who runs this country has created it. I mean, it is appalling what has happened to this country. This is not the country that I was born and grew up in, and it has been straight downhill ever since, actually since they murdered JFK in Dealey Plaza in 1963. This country has been on a downward trajectory ever since, and it's time for the American people to take it back and to restore the Democratic Republic in its rightful way by honoring the votes, the legal votes, not the illegal votes, not the attempted fraud, not the attempted coup. But it's time for that, and the America will restore its reputation around the globe very, very quickly once that happens.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid that's all the time that we have for this edition of The Debate. Senior geopolitical analyst Patricia DeGennaro from Washington, D.C., also editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris from Phoenix. Thanks to both of you for taking part in this edition, and thanks for